Good afternoon, everyone. This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. It is Friday, April 19th, and for the next hour, we will be bringing you news from the Worcester Telegram and Gazette. Thanks to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. I am Yolanda Moore, and I'm reading this morning with Max Cantor. We're coming to you live from the Patricia A. Fletcher Studio at Audio Journal in Worcester, Massachusetts. We will begin with our obituaries, and we have a listing here, but not much information about it. And it is for Nancy Skwaronski. She was 81 from Royalston. She died April 15th. The arrangements are under, I guess it's the Stone Ledoux funeral home. Services are April 22nd at 10 a.m. at the Stone Ledoux funeral home. And then she will be buried in the Jonas Align Cemetery, and that's all we have on Nancy Skwaronski. So then we will start with, from Luster, we have Paul Radzewski. The Radzewski family announces the passing of Paul Radzewski at the age of 59. Paul was a ray of light to our family who will be remembered for all his love, kindness, and loyalty. He had an understanding nature that could make you laugh and feel better in the most dire situations. His greatest joy was being at the beach with his family and friends. Paul was the owner and operator of Paul's Sails and Floor Coverings for many years. He was an accomplished handyman, blessed with carpentry and mechanical skills. He leaves behind one son and one daughter, a brother and a sister, and a niece's cousins and friends. He was born in Worcester, son of the late Walter and Ruth Radzewski. Calling hours will be held on Sunday, April 21st, from 2 to 4:30 p.m. in the Henry Dursa Funeral Home, 33 Ward Street in Worcester. A service will be held at 4 p.m. during the calling hours. Burial will be private and will be in the Notre Dame Cemetery in Worcester. Again, that is for Paul Radzewski of Luster. Next, we have Frederick Zolkowski of Grafton, also known as Fred, 82, passed away at home on April 16th. He leaves three children, four siblings, eight grandchildren, and two great-grandchildren. He was born in Toledo, Ohio, son of the late Irene and John Zolkowski. He was a graduate of St. Francis de Sales High School and received his bachelor's degree from the University of Toledo and his doctorate in electrical engineering from the University of Illinois. He worked at Radiant Technology in Stowe for many years, retiring just a few weeks prior to his passing. Fred was always passionate about his work and was determined to stay in his career as long as he could. He also found joy in his garden or in the kitchen, cooking for his family and delighting in them, enjoying the time and his food. All are welcome to gather with Fred's family and friends on Friday, April 19th, from 4 to 7 p.m. at the Roney Funeral Home, 152 Worcester Street, North Grafton. His funeral mass will be celebrated on Saturday, April 20th at 12 p.m. at St. James Church, 89 Main Street in South Grafton. He will then be laid to rest at Pine Grove Cemetery in North Grafton. Again, that was for Frederick Zolkowski of Grafton. From Palmer, we have Father Michael Marcinowski, 67, died April 11th at Tufts Medical Center in Boston. He leaves his wife, Nina, to whom he was married for 44 years. He is survived by one son, two daughters, one grandson, and one sister. Father Michael was a Greek Orthodox priest for 25 years and retired from Hewlett-Packard Corporation after 40 years. He earned two master's degrees and a museum studies certificate, and he was also an avid runner. He loved his church and his family and will be dearly missed. There are no services listed for Father Michael Marcinowski of Palmer. From Auburn, we have Simone M. Walsh, Simone Paradise Walsh, 77 of Auburn, died Tuesday, April 16th at home. Funeral services in St. Joseph's Church will be privately held. O'Connor Brothers Funeral Home, 592 Park Avenue in Worcester, is assisting the family with those arrangements for Simone Walsh of Auburn. We have from Worcester, June T. Soloperto, passed away on April 16th. She was born to Nishan and Helen Nishanian of Worcester, and was a cherished member of the Worcester community where she was born and raised. June graduated from South High School, earned a bachelor's degree in education from Worcester State College. Her passion led her into the medical field, where she started her career working as a dental assistant for Dr. Lambert. She later took a role in the physical therapy industry as an office coordinator. Growing up in an Armenian family, every family function and gathering was centered around food. June carried out that tradition in her own kitchen, cooking amazing Armenian-American dishes. Her famous rice pilaf was loved by all. June is predeceased by her parents, Helen and Nishan Nishanian. She is survived by her husband, David, one son, one daughter, two grandchildren, and one sister. June's family extends a heartfelt invitation to relatives and friends to join them in a time of remembrance and support from 9 to 11:30 on Saturday, April 20th, at the Armenian Church of Our Savior, located at 87 Salisbury Street in Worcester. A funeral service will commence at 11:30. Following this service, we will proceed to Hope Cemetery in Worcester for the interment. Funeral arrangements are in the care of the Miles Funeral Home, 1158 Main Street in Holden. And that, again, was for June T. Soloperto of Worcester. From Northborough, we have Joseph E. Wheeler, 90, passed away at UMass Memorial University campus on April 15th. Joe was born and raised in Brooklyn, to George and Madeline Wheeler. He attended Brooklyn Boys High School and, after graduation, enlisted in the U.S. Army. For most all of his career, Joe worked in heavy construction, first as a laborer, then working his way into supervisory positions. He worked with Perini Construction. Joe was proud to be involved with large projects such as the New York City subway system, building of McCarran Airport, reconstruction of the Southborough Aqueduct, to name a few. He was just as proud and perhaps had more fun driving a Mr. Softy ice cream truck through local neighborhoods. In addition to his wife, Gloria, Joe is survived by his son and one son and one daughter. A funeral mass will be celebrated at 11 a.m. on Monday, April 22nd at St. Rose of Lima Parish, 244 West Main Street in Northborough. Burial will be in Howard Street Cemetery, Northborough. There are no calling hours. Arrangements are under the care of the Hayes Funeral Home, 56 Main Street in Northborough. Again, that was for Joseph E. Wheeler, 90 of Northborough. And lastly, we have Kim Marie Magnuson of Worcester, passed away on April 13th. Kim grew up in the Worcester area, graduated from Quinsigamond Community College. She worked in the hospitality field for many years before recently retiring. Kim is survived by two sons, her mother, Barbara Affalt, and two sisters. Kim had six grandchildren, and she will be remembered by those who knew her as a kind and loving and giving person. Kim will be forever missed. The family is planning a celebration of life gathering at another time. Again, that was for Kim Marie Magnuson of Worcester. And that was it for our obituaries. And now we have this story, headline being, Free Worcester Bus Rides Will Continue Into 2025. The free rides will continue. The Worcester Regional Transit Authority Advisory Board voted unanimously on Thursday to keep fares free as part of the authority's budget for the next fiscal year through June of 2025. WRTA buses are now budgeted as free for a fifth year, dating to the start of COVID-19. We are thrilled that the WRTA board has voted to continue free fare service. Today, ridership is higher than pre-pandemic levels and higher than it's ever been. With the extension of the program, families and residents in WRTA service areas will continue to have access to affordable transit, Deb Carey of the Massachusetts Audubon Society and the Zero Fare Worcester Coalition said in a prepared statement. Free fares reduce greenhouse gas emissions by getting people out of cars onto public transit. This is an initiative that addresses the environmental and that addresses the environment and equity. Meantime, the authority is reporting increased ridership. The WRTA Advisory Board approved a fiscal 2025 budget of $37,250,134. The advisory board allocated $4,533,000 in remaining funding from the 2020 Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act. According to representation by Deputy WRTA Administrator and CFO Tom Coyne, the WRTA would have a remaining CARES Act balance of over $16 million. And a federal American Rescue Plan Act funding balance of over $2,800,000 at the end of the fiscal year. The Worcester Regional Research Bureau advocated for a fare-free Worcester Regional Transit Authority in a May 2019 report amid declining ridership. The idea quickly gained momentum as a method to boost ridership, make the system more economically and socially equitable, and to help the environment. The start of the COVID-19 pandemic the following year also led to the WRTA suspending fares in March of 2020. The WRTA also instituted rear door boarding to ease congestion and allow greater social distancing. However, the WRTA also substantially reduced service in 2020 while people stayed home. 4 years removed from the stay-at-home phase of the COVID-19 pandemic, the authority saw a strong rise in ridership this past year. A representation of WRTA Administrator Goals for fiscal 2025 states that fixed route ridership for fiscal 2023-2022 to June of 23 was 33% higher, just under 4 million passenger trips. Fixed route ridership for fiscal 2019 was a little over 3 million. Fiscal 2025 runs from July 1st, 2024 to June 30th, 2025. The Advisory Board Chairman Doug Belanger said during the all-remote Thursday meeting that 2025 was a balanced budget. Government and business leaders praised the free fare decision. Free fare policies help more riders access public transportation, which benefits our residents, our employers, our economy, and our environment. The WRTA is a leader in implementing a fare-free policy, and other regions are following our lead, said Senator Robin Kennedy. The Worcester Regional Chamber of Commerce has also advocated for continuing zero fare. We know from speaking daily with our member businesses of all sizes and from all sectors of our local economy that they are desperately trying to fill employment needs, Timothy Murray, president and CEO of the Worcester Regional Chamber of Commerce, said in a statement also provided by the Zero Fare Group. And there is a picture here of a Worcester RTA bus as it's traveling on up Front Street on Thursday with a big headline that says free fare. So that certainly is a big help. And that's going to be it for the front page news. We're going to take a short break, and then Max is going to bring you some local news.
Mm-hmm. Are you elderly or disabled? Did you know each WRTA fixed route bus has a number of accessibility features such as a ramp to enter, a kneeler which can lower the bus, a securement area for wheelchairs and other mobility devices, priority seating for people with disabilities, electronic signage on the front, side, and rear exterior, a bicycle rack on the front exterior, an interior stop request sign, automated audio and visual stop announcements. Let us make your transportation needs easier and ride the bus with us. Call us with questions at 508-791-9782 or visit our website at www.therta.com.
Hi, welcome back. This is Max Cantor, and here is the Worcester 5-day weather forecast. Today, it will be cloudy and warmer with a high of 56 and a low of 44 degrees. Tomorrow, expect rain and drizzle in the morning with a high of 59 and a low of 37. On Sunday, there'll be sun mixing with clouds, a high of 53 and a low of 40. On Monday, it'll be mostly sunny with a high of 58 and a low of 40. On Tuesday, it'll be clouds and sun with a high of 61 and a low of 44 degrees. Sunrise this morning was today at 6 a.m., and sunset will be at 7:34 p.m. On Saturday, sunrise will be at 5:58 a.m., and sunset will be at 7:35 p.m. And now for an article from the local news section. The title is Fires from Lithium Batteries on the Rise, More Than Double State's Annual Average. There's a marked increase in the number of fires in Massachusetts caused by lithium-ion batteries that power items like electric cars, smartphones, and e-bikes. The State Department of Fire Services reported 50 such fires in the past 6 months, more than double the annual average of roughly 19 from 2019 to 2023. Worcester had 5 fires caused by these batteries since June, with 4 of the 5 in the last 6 months, said Assistant Fire Chief Adam Roche. They occurred in a laptop, hoverboard, 2 cell phones, and a flashlight. The laptop situation was unusual, said Roche, because the battery was still in its delivery box and never installed in the computer. Luckily, said Roche, the fire was caught early when a resident noticed the box was smoking. If nobody was around, Roche said, there could have been thermal runaway, which occurs when a battery becomes overheated and can explode, sending out toxic gases that could ignite nearby items. As for the statewide increase, a new tool called the Lithium Ion Battery Fire Investigation Checklist tracked the hike. We knew anecdotally that lithium ion batteries were involved in more fires than the existing data suggested, said State Fire Marshal John Devine in a prepared statement. In just the past 6 months, investigators using this simple checklist have revealed many more incidents than we've seen in prior years. Beyond the new checklist, Fire Services noted the 50 fires could be due to more consumer devices powered by lithium-ion batteries, increased attention by local fire investigators, or other factors. Lithium-ion batteries, noted Fire Services, run the risk of failing quickly, without warning if they're overcharged, overheated, or not used correctly. Thermal runaway could result. Water and traditional fire extinguishers are significantly less effective in these types of fires. And then a subtitle, breakdown of the 50 fires. In the most common categories, 9 involved micromobility devices like battery-powered scooters, e-bikes, and hoverboards. 8 were connected to laptops, and 8 more were involved, and 8 more involved cell phones, tablets, or similar devices. Power tools accounted for 6 fires. The device's charging status could be determined in 41 of the 50 fires. Meanwhile, the majority of the devices, 56%, were not charging at the time of the fire. The following are tips for preventing lithium-ion batteries by the State Fire Services. Have working smoke alarms installed on every level of your home. Use only the manufacturer's batteries and charging equipment. Others may be cheaper, but are more likely to cause a hazard. Store scooters and e-bikes outdoors if possible. If indoors, keep them and their batteries clear of doors, windows, and stairways. charge the battery directly from a wall outlet, not an extension cord or power strip. Place it on a hard and stable surface and not a bed, couch, or pillow. Charge only one battery or device at a time and unplug it when it's fully charged. Don't allow a charged battery to continue charging. If you notice changes to the battery or the device, including damage, unusual odor, change in color, too much heat, change in shape, leaking, smoking, or not keeping a charge, stop using it right away. Also, when it's time to dispose of the battery, don't put it in the trash. Lithium-ion batteries should be recycled, and you can find a location at the URL call2recycle.org/locator. All right. And now for the next article titled, Southbridge Students Can Earn College-Level Credits. Starting this fall, Southbridge students can earn college-level credits from Consigamond Community College, or QCC. The State Board of Elementary and Secondary Education and Board of Higher Education recently approved the program, which is free for students. About 100 Southbridge High School juniors and seniors will be eligible to earn college-level credits at QCC under the Massachusetts Early College Initiative. The Massachusetts Early College Initiative is a state-funded program created in 2017 to connect public schools districts to local colleges for students to earn free credits. QCC was first designated as an early college site in 2018 for Worcester Public Schools, according to the Massachusetts Department of Higher Education. In 2019, Marlborough Public Schools was also added to the program. Worcester State University is also an early college site for Worcester Public Schools and Veritas Preparatory Charter School in Springfield. This is an important designation that will have positive, far-reaching implications for Southbridge High School students and the Southbridge community as a whole, said QCC President Luis G. Pedraja. Through the program, Southbridge High students will take QCC courses twice a week with support programming 3 days a week, which will include topics such as reader readiness, growth mindset, and learning strategies, according to a statement by the college. The high school will also shape its course schedule for participating students so they can attend classes and access QCC support services such as tutoring and library services. College-level credits students earn through the program will transfer towards certificates or associate or bachelor's degrees at Massachusetts community colleges or state universities, according to the statement by QCC. The whole idea is to give opportunity to students who may not have thought that college could be something in their life, said Christina Hebert, QCC Director of Educational Partnership and Early College Initiatives. Early college prepares them to be successful in college and the workplace while saving them time and money. The statement of QCC added that Southbridge High School students already attend college-level classes through the college's satellite location at the high school and through English for Speakers of Other Languages and General Education Development programs. Since 2017, the Southbridge Schools District has been under a state receivership, a common practice for underperforming school districts that are taken under management by the state for improvement. A request for comment from the district was not immediately returned. All right, and now time for my next article. Title is Costello's Truck Repair is Purchased. AAA Northeast has purchased the former Costello's Truck Service and Repair property at 315 to 317 Southwest Cutoff, with plans for a fleet facility. According to documents filed with the Worcester Registry of Deeds, AAA Northeast acquired the property from a limited liability company known as ABS Real Estate, managed by Costello's owner, Robert Costello Jr. The deed was executed April 5th. The property was empty Wednesday afternoon with signage for the truck service business taken down. A fence was also placed in front of the property. A phone number listed on the business website was not operational. A spokesperson for AAA Northeast, which serves Massachusetts, Rhode Island, New York, Connecticut, New Hampshire, and New Jersey, said AAA will use the property for a fleet facility for AAA vehicles. The facility will replace a lease vehicle facility. The facility will replace a leased fleet facility property in Millbury. Costello's offered fleet maintenance, mobile truck service, and truck repairs, according to its website. In 2022, U-Haul Company of Massachusetts and Ohio Inc. announced it signed Costello's as a U-Haul neighborhood dealer, a non-franchise business that committed lot space to U-Haul equipment. And then included is a picture of the lot, and just reiterating what it said already in the article. And then also, there were just some pictures with the headline, Upwardly Mobile. School vacation proved to be a good time to reach new heights. The climbing wall has been busy at Central Rock Gym on Barber Avenue, with students testing their vertical skills this week. And the top picture is someone climbing up a very difficult rock wall incline, with the subtitle, Mason Williams, 19, and a senior at Winchington School tries out bouldering. Below that are two pictures next to each other, one of a man holding a belay and one of a girl on the belay up on the wall. The first one is Adrian Santiago acts as belayer for his daughter Lila as she tries top roping. And the second of the little girl is Lila Santiago, 7, looks down from the top to her father Adrian, who is acting as belayer and spotter for her. All right. And then that's going to be it. We're going to be heading into our break. Thank you.
People with disabilities adapt on a daily basis. They're people you want on your team. And we're here to help you find blind and visually impaired professionals to help you reach your organizational goals. Building an inclusive workforce where individuals with disabilities are welcome is possible thanks to Mass Commission for the Blind. Partner with them to hire individuals who are blind or visually impaired and reach your workforce goals. The success of your organization depends on the diversity of your team. Call 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB to learn how you can become an employer partner for the blindness community. That's 1-800-392-6450 or mass.gov/MCB.
Okay, welcome back. It is now 12:27. You are listening to a reading of the Telegram and Gazette, a production of Audio Journal. And I will do some business news. And this one, Dollar Tree plans to sell $7 items at their stores. We're a long way from five and dimes these days. Discount retail giant Dollar Tree is raising the price cap in their stores to $7, the company announced in its fourth quarter earnings call. This year, across 3,000 stores, we expect to expand our multi-price assortment of over 300 items at price points ranging from $1.50 to $7, Dollar Tree CEO Rick Dreeling said in a call on March 13th. Questions remain about when the higher-priced items will reach store shelves. The company did not expand on the timing of when the $7 items would appear. Dreeling said that the company is accelerating the rollout of additional price tiers in its fourth quarter report. U.S. Today reached out to Dollar Tree about the timeline for implementing the $7 price cap and has not gotten a response. In 2021, the company announced that it would expand its Dollar Tree Plus concept that includes merchandise at the $3 and $5 price points. The company said when the concept was announced that it planned to have 500 Dollar Tree Plus stores by the end of 2021, with another 1,500 in 2022 and at least 5,000 by the end of 2024. Dollar Tree operated 16,774 stores across 48 states and 5 Canadian provinces as of February 3rd. Then Dollar Tree CEO Mike Witinsky's salary was about $14 million in 2022, with the median employee at Dollar Tree making just under $15,000 annually. The first time Dollar Tree lifted its price threshold was in 2019, when the company introduced items priced at $1.25. The company made the price its standard just 2 years later as a part of the company's expanding its offerings. Lifting the $1 constraint represents a monumental step for our organization, and we are enthusiastic about the opportunity to meaningfully improve our shoppers' experience and unlock value for our stakeholders, Witinski said in a 2021 statement. Okay, and then we have Disney's expansion plan clears a big hurdle. Excuse me. Plans to expand the Disneyland Resort cleared a major hurdle Wednesday as local officials endorsed a new blueprint governing the development of Walt Disney's Southern California theme parks over the next 40 years. The Anaheim City Council approved a plan called Disneyland Forward that one researcher estimated would create as many as 4,520 construction jobs per year of development and an additional 26,764 parks-related positions over the coming decades. The second procedural council vote to consider zoning changes, revisions in the city's development agreement with Disney, and an analysis of environmental impacts is scheduled for May 7th. If adopted, the changes would take effect after 30 days, clearing the way for Disney to invest a minimum of $1.9 billion in new theme park experiences and lodging over the next decade. Parks have become a reliable profit engine for Disney and have helped cushion losses in the Disney Plus streaming business, which is expected to become profitable by September. The company last year announced it would deepen its investments in its parks and double the capacity of its cruise line, committing $60 billion over the next decade. Disneyland, the company's first theme park, opened in 1955. As it grew in popularity, the city of Anaheim approved plans that would govern its growth, creating zones designated for specific types of developments. In 2021, Disney submitted its Disney Forward plan, which would give the company flexibility in how it could develop its 490-acre California property. Disney is looking to blend hotels, shops, and attractions within the same themed world as it has in Fantasy Springs, which opened June 6th in the Tokyo Disney Sea Park. The proposals call for allowing theme park attractions alongside hotels on the west side of Disneyland Drive and theme park attractions along new shopping, dining, and entertainment to the southeast on what is today the Toy Story parking area. Dozens of members of the public addressed the council before the vote. Many voiced enthusiastic support for the job opportunities and revenue they expected the expansion to bring to the area. But some local residents, however, said they would be harmed by increased traffic and noise and the conversion of a public road known as Magic Way into a pedestrian walkway. A project like Disneyland Forward will only further exacerbate the current problems, said an Anaheim resident. To disregard the human costs from a project of this scope is unthinkable. The company has not said what attractions and amenities it plans to add in California, although it has pointed to attractions found elsewhere, such as the Mammalian Metropolis in Zootopia in the Shanghai Disneyland. Okay, and then we have this. Prices up and sales are down in the early spring house market. Signs of spring are all around us. The days are getting warmer, baseball is back, and Massachusetts home prices are setting records as demand continues to significantly outpace the inventory of sales, to outpace the inventory of houses for sale. The real estate analysts at the Warren Group reported Wednesday morning that $580,000 was the median price of the 2,563 single-family homes sold in the Bay State in March. That's a new record for March. Meanwhile, the number of houses sold last month was down. In Worcester County, the median price for a single-family home was $433,000 for 361 sales, a $38,000 increase when compared with the same month last year when 389 houses were sold. Condominium sales in the county totaled 121 last month, which was identical to the same last year. The median price on that was $350,000, something comparable to the same month last year when the median price was only $100 lower. Cassidy Norton, associate publisher and media relations director for the Warren Group, said it was not surprising that the median price of homes continues to set records and suggested a reason for some optimism. Despite the increase, we actually aren't seeing the rapid double-digit percent increases we were experiencing at the height of the pandemic and the subsequent months. Despite this slowdown, limited inventory will probably continue to be the biggest barrier to home ownership in the coming months. Through March, there had been 7,001 single-family home sales in Massachusetts in 2024. At the same time, the year-to-date median single-family home sales price is up 9.8% to $560,000, the Warren Group said. Condominium sales were also down last month to the fewest in March sales since 2015, 4,131 sales compared to 1,520 last March. Housing in Massachusetts is inaccessible or unaffordable for many residents, and Governor Maura Healey last year identified housing as the number one issue facing this state. She said as recently as last month, we are short 200,000 housing units in this state. And then we have this. Social media used to exclude Trump jurors. Former President Donald Trump's trial team is using a powerful weapon in its efforts to come up with a winning jury in its New York criminal hush money case, social media. Two men were struck from consideration Tuesday after Trump's team uncovered social media posts that Judge Juan Merchan concluded raised concerns when it came to their fairness and impartiality in the trial. One potential juror posted, "Get him out and lock him up," about the former president after celebrating that a court struck down a Trump travel ban. When the man was questioned about it and said he didn't still believe Trump should be locked up, Trump flashed a smirk. "I don't think that I can allow this juror to remain," Merchan said. The other man posted a parody video featuring Trump that was titled, "I'm dumb as expletive." He also posted, "No one is above the law," about Trump's separate criminal case dealing with his handling of classified documents. The victories for Trump came as he faces 34 felony counts of falsifying business records. Trump has pleaded not guilty. Prospective jurors may not have realized that their social media posts from years ago would be picked over in front of the national media, but jury consultant Joe Allen Demetrius said it's common in high-profile cases. Demetrius, who has worked on many such trials, such as O.J. Simpson's murder trial, told USA Today in advance of Trump's trial that social media would be a key tool in evaluating responses to the list of 42 questions Merchan decided on for potential jurors. "I would align it to a polygraph test," Demetrius said, "but looking at their oral responses to the questionnaire and then comparing that to what they may have on social media, you can see if they are being forthcoming or if they may be hiding something. There remains the risk that people eager to get on the jury will realize their social media could be checked and erase things in advance," a prospect Demetrius called frightening. Demetrius expressed concern that Merchan released the juror questionnaire publicly days before jury selection started on Monday. "At this point, there is also media coverage of the role social media has played in selection. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out. You're summoned for jury duty in criminal court in New York City on August 15th. Well, guess what trial you're being summoned for," she said. The Trump team didn't get Merchan to strike all the potential jurors they wanted gone based on social media activity. Merchan allowed one potential juror to stay in consideration despite posting a video on Facebook of anti-Trump celebrations on a street. Trump lawyer Susan Nicheles described the video as clearly an anti-Trump event that she's out celebrating and partying at. Before the woman was questioned, Mershan agreed it was an anti-Trump event, but said it wasn't clear the potential juror herself was there. Upon questioning, the woman said she remembered seeing the event as she was walking outside and maintained she could be fair and impartial in the case. Another jury candidate was allowed to stay after Mershan said that her posts were satire and that she had been fairly open about disagreeing with Trump on politics. Yet another potential juror was allowed to remain after the Trump team took issue with a post by her husband, which Mershan said was from 8 years ago. And the beat goes on. Okay, we're going to take a break, and Max will be back with some entertainment and some sports.
Hello, everybody. This is Bill Ruggiero. Join me for my live weather reports, heard every weekday mornings on the Morning Report, right here on Audio Journal. Get your first forecast without waiting for a forecaster. That's the Morning Report, heard every weekday mornings from 7:30 a.m. to 8 a.m. only from Audio Journal, part of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
Hi, this is Max Kander, and I'm going to start with reading a movie review. The title is The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, A Bloody Good Time. Director Guy Ritchie doesn't miss when he's completely in his element. His newest feature, part thriller, part action comedy, and based on true events, titled The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, is a perfect example of Ritchie's confidence in what he's doing and doing it well. Part spy thriller, part action comedy, it's proof positive that a great movie can be flashy, fun, and ridiculous, with an uncomplicated plot and still work. Stranger Than Fiction, the movie is adapted from the 2014 book Churchill's Secret Warriors, the explosive true story of the Special Forces desperados of World War II by Damian Lewis. The film follows Prime Minister Winston Churchill's covert British World War II organization, the Special Operations Executive, which played a significant part in the victory over Nazi Germany. The organization also laid the groundwork for modern-day black operations. The Special Operations team was a band of misfits, each with their own special skill, spearheaded by the fearless leader Gus March Phillips, played brilliantly and effortlessly by Henry Cavill. Their task? Take down the biggest Nazi U-boat undetected within a designated time frame. I love a movie that starts out swinging. In this case, it's also literal, as we see the main characters spilling Nazi blood on their tiny fishing boat with zero context and a lot of witty one-liners. It was captivating and perfectly set the tone for the film. The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare is everything you want in a movie. The fight scenes are bloody and exciting. The dialogue is tongue-in-cheek. Every joke landed, and not one actor felt out of place. Each actor brought their own sparkle that created a dynamic that meshed and was a truly beautiful bromance to behold. Ritchie's success with the Sherlock Holmes movies proved he can make a big, boisterous movie and shoot it in a way that feels effortless, while easily moving the plot forward. Ritchie manages to take a small piece of the larger World War II puzzle and make it feel high stakes, even though it was just the beginning of something much bigger. While the gang of misfits are on a mission to blow up Nazi U-boats, their more sophisticated partners in crime are getting up close and personal with Nazi soldiers to create distractions and gain more information about their enemy. All of this is seamlessly woven together and reaches a big climax. There's an intriguing plot, likable characters who walk away from big explosions, sniping Nazi soldiers, stealing ships Jack Sparrow style, and a clever intelligence test a la The Princess Bride. What more could we ask from a movie? And the movie is rated R, and the reviewer, Meredith G. White, gave it 4.5 stars. right. And now for Today in History. Today, on Friday, April 19th, there are 256 days left in the year. On this date, in 1775, the shot heard around the world. The American Revolution began as British troops and colonial militiamen collided in Lexington and Concord, Mass. In 1882, Charles Darwin, the architect of the theory of biological evolution by natural selection, died from heart failure at age 73 in Down, England. In 1943, in German-occupied Poland, Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto rose against German troops moving to liquidate the area. The uprising lasted a month and tragically cost the lives of 13,000 Jews. And in 1971, Charles Manson was convicted of murder and sentenced to death for the Tate-LaBianca murders. His sentence was later commuted to life in prison. While Manson was not physically involved in the killings, the court found him guilty of first-degree murder and conspiracy along with three others from his cult. And now for people in the news. Prince William back to public duties after cancer revelation. Prince William returned to public duties on Thursday for the first time since his wife Kate revealed she was undergoing preventative chemotherapy for cancer. In a video message last month, Kate, age 42, the Princess of Wales, said tests taken following major abdominal surgery she underwent in January had uncovered cancer, something she described as a huge shock. William, 41, has been absent from official engagements since then, as the couple and their three young children come to terms with the impact of the news. Although he and his eldest son, Prince George, were pictured watching their favorite soccer team, Aston Villa, play last week, Thursday marked the first time William carried out official public appearances since Kate's highly personal announcement. Harry Potter Star Wars actor Davis mourns death of wife. Star Wars and Harry Potter star Warwick Davis is mourning the loss of his wife and best friend. In a statement released Wednesday by Lucasfilm, the actor confirmed his wife, Samantha Davis, died on March 24th. He remembered his soulmate as a devoted mother, my favorite human, and my most trusted confidant and an ardent supporter of everything I did in my career. A cause of death was not provided. The most open, warm person I have ever known, Davis wrote. Her passing has left a huge hole in our lives as a family. Davis is known for his roles as Wicket in Star Wars Return of the Jedi, the title hero in Willow, and Professor Phileas Flitwick in the Harry Potter movies. And now for what's playing as far as movies on TV. The entertainment on Turner Classic Movies tonight is escapist on a few levels. It's a lineup of five movies involving escapes from World War II or the Cold War. Starting things off naturally is the most famous one, The Great Escape, 1963, director John Sturges' legendary feature that fictionalizes a real-life mass escape by Allied POWs from a German prison camp during World War II. Steve McQueen, James Garner, Richard Attenborough, and Charles Bronson lead the cast. The next film is set in pre-war Nazi Germany, Escape, 1940, featuring Robert Taylor as an American who tries to free his mother, played by Russian-American actress Nazimova, from a concentration camp. Norma Shearer and Conrad Veidt also star. Two Cold War-era movies follow, Escape from East Berlin, 1962, an American West German thriller, and Escape from the Iron Curtain, 1956, also known as Flight from Vienna. The lineup goes back to World War II as it concludes early tomorrow with I Escaped from the Gestapo, 1943, led by Dean Jagger, John Carradine, and Mary Bryan. All right, and now some things that are showing on TV. Cesar Millan, Better Human, Better Dog. Nat Geo, 9 p.m. Caesar helps Juice, an overexcited pit bull, find calmness while matching the Mejia family with their new forever dog. The Barnes Brunch, WETV, 10 p.m., a new series. This new reality series follows NBA champion slash podcaster Matt Barnes and his fiancée, model Anansa Sims, as they blend their two families and six children, aged 5 to 15. Along with their supportive parents, including Sims' mother, former supermodel Beverly Johnson, the couple will take viewers inside their home and very active lives as they navigate fame, love, and parenting. All right. And now we're moving on to sports. The title is Nor'easter to Marathon. From a nor'easter to a marathon, it's been a hectic few weeks for Ryan Loeffler. On April 5th, the Woo Sox assistant field superintendent helped remove mounds and mounds of snow from the field at Polar Park to allow the AAA club to host a doubleheader. 10 days later, the 42-year-old from Connecticut ran mile after mile to finish the 128th running of the Boston Marathon. The day after, Loeffler was back in Worcester, preparing the playing surface ahead of a 6-game homestand between the Worcester Red Sox and Durham Bulls. No rest for the weary. "It's been busy. It's always something," Loeffler said. "It's been a whirlwind, but I enjoy it the entire time. Snowstorms, everything, I would do it again in a heartbeat." After a rare April storm dropped a few inches of snow in the Canal District, Loeffler and his fellow grounds crew members spent nearly 20 hours trying to remove the snowfall from Polar Park in the middle of Worcester's opening homestand. When Loeffler went on a run the next day as preparation for his second Boston Marathon, his left Achilles started to feel tight. A day later, he had to shut down his run completely. "It was painful," Loeffler said. With the marathon just a week away, Loeffler threw everything he could at the injury: ice, heat, biofreeze, Tiger Balm. 2 days before the race, when Loeffler picked up his bib in Boston, he tested out his Achilles in a 5K run around the city. "I was like, oh man, I may not finish," he said. And thankfully he did. For the first 7 miles of the 26.2-mile trek from Hopkinton to Boston on Marathon Monday, Loeffler felt good. But then his Achilles started to act up again. So the longtime runner, who raised money for the Red Sox Foundation, decided to slow down his pace in order to finish his 8th marathon. Better late than never. "I probably broke the record for high fives," Loeffler said. "It was a memorable day, though. I would do it over again a million times." Once Loeffler crossed the finish line and caught up with family and friends, he devoured a burger and fries from Cask and Flagon. He then treated himself to sweets for the first time since Thanksgiving. The order? A brownie sundae. "Desserts for everyone," Loeffler said. Less than 14 hours later, Loeffler was back in his element at Polar Park, combing over every nook and cranny of the infield dirt with a slight hitch in his giddy-up. "I was just proud I was able to run out for the drag of the infield," Loeffler said. "Tuesday was a struggle physically to get through this stuff, and even still today I'm hurting." From dealing with dirt to snow to asphalt and then back to dirt, it's been a whirlwind of a few weeks for the Woo Sox groundskeeper. But Ryan Loeffler wouldn't want it any other way. "I had a marathon day of plowing snow one weekend, and then the next weekend was a marathon day of running in like 75-degree heat," Loeffler said. "But it's been a dream come true, even though I had a slower time, but I would still do it 100 times out of 100. And included are a couple pictures of him working as the groundskeeper for Polar Park and showing him raking the infield between innings. All right, moving on to one more sports article. Clark's Taylor gives back to local youth. As a 10 and 11-year-old, Clark University junior Isaiah Taylor attended the Academic Basketball Awareness Camp at Merrimack College, where he and 150 other kids from the Lawrence Boys and Girls Club moved into the dorms, learning basketball and life skills, and made forever friends. Those summer weeks were among the most powerful of Taylor's life, and when he had the opportunity, he knew he wanted to do something similar for today's youth. Taylor now has that chance through his Engaged Athlete Fellowship from The Team, a nonpartisan organization that creates award-winning programming focused on integrating civic engagement and community service into college athletics. From 9 a.m. to noon Saturday at Clark's Neeler Athletic Center, Taylor will host a free basketball clinic for boys and girls in kindergarten through 8th grade. It's a great way for kids to finish up their April school vacation week and is a project Taylor is passionate about. My whole reasoning behind this is because of the great people I met at the camps I went to when I was younger, Taylor said. I'm going to do something like that because I feel that has had one of the biggest and most lasting impacts on me. Like myself, I hope they get an experience that sticks with them for a long time, Taylor said. I'll be a resource for any kid that wants to use me. I want to be that big brother figure to these kids like I had, or if not to me, one of my teammates, hopefully. Taylor, who grew up in Methuen, is just one of 28 athletes from around the nation chosen for prestigious fellowship this academic year. All right, and now back to Yolanda for the closing.
Oh, thank you, Max. A couple of two interesting stories there. Not your typical sports, but that's okay because those other stories are always good, too. This local news program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Programming is funded in part by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind, the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind, and Unibank. If you have any suggestions for our program, please call 508-797-1117 and let us know. We would love to hear from you. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or you can go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android service. I am Yolanda Moore. I had the pleasure this morning of reading with one of our new readers, Max Cantor. I'm sure you'll be hearing from him again. We both wish you a great day and a great weekend. Be safe, and we'll be back next Friday.
Hello once again, Audio Journal listeners. This is Bill Ruggiero with your latest weather forecast for today, Friday, April 19th, 2024. For today, we're looking at mostly sunny skies with showers likely in the afternoon, highs near 61 degrees. For tonight, rain, drizzle, and fog late. Low will be near 41 degrees. And the outlook for Saturday is called for a shower early, otherwise clearing in the afternoon. Highs Saturday near 64 degrees. Saturday night, mostly clear skies, low around 35 degrees. And the outlook for Sunday is called for mostly sunny skies, highs near 68 to 72 degrees. Also, we got sunny skies on Monday with just a chance of a shower. And then Tuesday and Wednesday, expect a chance of showers and thunderstorms likely throughout the day. Highs both days near 68 degrees. That, folks, is your latest weather forecast for today, Friday, April 19th, 2024. This has been Bill Ruggiero saying have a good and happy day, everybody. And please stay tuned for more programming coming up next on Audio Journal. Take care. Have a wonderful Friday and a wonderful weekend, everybody. Talk to you Monday. Bye.
Hello, listeners. This is Thomas.
And Micah.
Spring is in the air. My favorite thing to do during the spring season is to go on some fantastic trips with my family.
My favorite part about spring is hanging out on the deck with my family, listening to music on a sunny afternoon.
Whether it's gardening,
jogging,
kayaking,
or bird watching,
be sure to make some time for your outdoor hobbies. Happy spring.
Audio Journal, the radio reading service of Central Massachusetts, is your best source for news, information, and entertainment for individuals who are blind or otherwise unable to access print material. We are a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like to know our broadcast schedule, go to the Audio Journal website at www.audiojournal.org or contact us, and we'll gladly send you a large print or braille program guide. Call 508-797-1117. 1117 or email info@audiojournal.org. Audio Journal connects listeners to their local communities. Have you heard the news? Make sure everyone knows you heard it on Audio Journal.